This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
One of the most baffling and misunderstood elements of the Idaho murders isn't how they happened, it's what happened after. According to prosecutors, Brian Koberger entered that house in the dead of night and murdered four people in under 20 minutes. He's even now agreed to it. But not everyone in that house was killed. Two roommates survived. And for hours, they said nothing to the outside world. No 911 call, no screaming, just fear, silence, texts, confusion, and a delayed discovery that for many in the public seemed impossible to explain. But what we know now, and what law enforcement has quietly understood from day one, is that trauma doesn't play by logic. It doesn't follow a script, and when someone stumbles into the aftermath of a massacre or watches a masked man pass by them in the hallway, the brain doesn't always say run, react, report. Sometimes it says freeze. This episode is about that freeze. With retired FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer, we're going deep into the behavioral analysis of what unfolded inside that house, not from the suspect's perspective, but from the surviving roommates. What did they see? What did they text? What does "I'm freaking out" mean when it's sent in real time, hours before a crime scene is discovered? We'll break down how trauma rewrites perception, how memory gets scrambled under stress, and why the brain sometimes protects us by shutting down what it doesn't fully understand. We'll also talk about how the FBI interprets these reactions, not as failures, but as trauma indicators. And for those who've judged these survivors online, we're addressing that too. Because the internet's the armchair analysis of all of this has missed a crucial fact. Surviving something like this doesn't mean you were lucky. It means your trauma begins in a very different way. Let's step inside the house and into the minds of the people who lived through the unthinkable. Let's talk about the witness trauma. This is something that if there is a good thing about the case not going to trial, other than the families, I know some of them are happy that they don't have to go through it. Obviously the Gonzalvas, and some others, not so much. I hear both ends, and I understand both ends as best as I can, not having, you know, a child that was lost like they're going through. But the other big part of this is the ones that survive, the two roommates downstairs that don't have to go on the stand. Thank God. They don't have to be cross-examined by Ann Taylor. They don't have to have their legitimacy questioned. But you still have folks out there. And I think it's dying down. I hope it continues to die down. But there's always a big thing. What's going on with them? Why were they not calling 911? They're texting, "I'm really confused. I'm freaking out." In real time, we're learning about all that. And we've learned in great detail about the accounts as to what went on that night, both in Howard Bloom's book and also in the James Patterson one. It goes into great detail. How did the FBI look at that initially? I mean, that is, you know, I guess on the surface, a little bizarre. If you got two people in the house that are not dead and everybody else is, you're going to wonder. But they obviously have a way of sorting out trauma and fact from fiction and strange behavior from traumatic behavior and behavior of someone who's just gone through, you know, one of the worst moments of their life. How was it that they walked so quickly into saying these girls have absolutely nothing to do with this when we look back on it?
Well, anytime you have a murder investigation, you start from within. You start in the smallest circle of people who are associated with your victims. So in this case, of course, the roommates are about as close as you can get because they were approximately close and they were emotionally close and they had a relationship with them. So you have to start breaking down, interview them, and then you corroborate what they say. Well, this was easy, or not corroborate one way or the other, mm-hmm. right? Either what they said makes sense or it doesn't from the independent facts. And in this case, it was easy because they had the cell phone information, they had the texting information. They were easily able to corroborate where these girls were in the house, what they were doing. They had all that information. So it was clear to them that they weren't involved in a murder at that time. There was no blood evidence leading to them, no DNA evidence. I mean, these girls hadn't covered up anything.
Yeah.
And so thankfully, one of the things in speaking of messaging that that department did, Moscow, they were brilliant in putting out, these people are off the list.
Mm-hmm.
Leave them alone. They are not our suspects. And in so many times, in so many cases, we don't see that happening. Like the Sebastian Rogers case, just put out, no, they're not being considered anymore, mm-hmm. whoever it might be, mm-hmm. whether grandparents, people, whatever. And in this case, they did a great job because they saw what was happening. You know, they saw the social media running wild and accusing all of these people of this murder. I mean, we even saw a professor that was accused of, and thankfully that social media person was indicted
mm-hmm.
for that. So that's how they were able to do it, Tony. And you always start within, and it became very clear that the inner circle wasn't responsible, that this was a stranger type offense. That became clear really very early on.
We live in a weird world with social media right now, and how anyone can almost say anything without a whole lot of repercussions. And it can be insanely damaging. We've seen it in this, and we've seen it in many other cases as well. And it's new territory where we have YouTube, where we have Facebook, where we have Twitter, we have TikTok, everything. It's all out there. Some of them are new, some of them are not. But in the big scheme of things, we're talking things that have existed really for 10, 15 years at the most, many of them less than that. And how quickly a rumor can spread and how quickly a life can be destroyed and a life can be ruined. Now, there's, of course, the balance of freedom of speech, being able to call something out and say, look, I think that someone should look here. And then there's, I'm going to call something out, but you're completely wrong on calling somebody out that has absolutely nothing against them. You're literally making things up or just going with rumors and repeating them over and over. Is this an area that we need to get better control of? Is there a way to get better control of it? I guess that's the bigger question. When you have these sort of things going on, because, I mean, these kids' lives were turned upside down with the internet trolling and sleuthing, if you will, that wanted to go down the road of blaming these young girls and even some others. But it takes a long time and it takes some money if you're going to try and go after them in a court of law. I mean, there are slander laws out there, but are they, do we need to reexamine some of this when it comes to accusing folks of crimes publicly?
You know, the slander and libel laws, I just don't think have ever caught up as of yet to mm-hmm. really what's happening with all these social media venues.
Yeah.
They're just not caught up and they need to really be rewritten. And it's interesting because slander and libel, of course, they have sort of two pieces. Well, certainly the defamation portion. You also have to prove that the person actually has had negativity happen to them, mm-hmm. right? In other words, that something bad has happened as a result of the slander. In other words, did somebody lose their job?
Mm-hmm.
Did somebody get falsely arrested? Was somebody kicked out of a neighborhood or something by a homeowners association? Something like that, that shows the quid pro quo, that the slander slash libel lined up with something detrimental happening to them. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is so often what the issue is, right? I mean, you can have a straight libel and slander mm-hmm. suit where you just show a lie.
Mm-hmm.
If you can prove it, this is the lie. Like Kash Patel recently filed a suit because a former FBI agent said that he spends more time in bars than he spends behind his desk on the seventh floor of the FBI headquarter building.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kash Patel has filed this, you know, suit against him saying that's just a lie. And I'm sure he can show mm-hmm. how much time he spent one place than the other. Of course, was that a tongue-in-cheek statement by that FBI agent? But sorry, I don't mean to digress.
No.
I just mean to say our laws just are not lined up with what happened to these kids. Yeah. For somebody who followed this from moment one, they went after Jack, the boyfriend of Kaylee Gonsalves, hard. I remember saying, "Oh my gosh, if this is the evidence you're going to use, you would never make it as any sort of investigator if this is what you're, you know, the stronghold of your case is." Because she called him in the morning. You know, those of us who have been young ladies and had a crush or maybe on a breakup and you have some cocktails and you call, love call, your interest ad nauseum, that doesn't mean he killed you. Yeah. And Dylan Mortensen, because she didn't call 911. Look, none of us could have imagined the atrocities that took place. We still don't know the full breadth of those atrocities, but none of us would have said, "Oh, I think I saw somebody in a mask. What is that going on with that? I bet you my four roommates have been murdered."
Yeah. Not a thought that would go through anyone's head whatsoever. Let's talk about
maybe now.
Yeah.
Maybe now.
And also maybe now too. And I don't know. I don't know what this is. This has been something I've always done through my entire life. Lock your doors. Just lock your doors. I don't care where you live. I don't care how big a city, as small a city, how safe a town. It's just kittens that live outside of your home and nothing else. Lock your door. And I know their lock was broken and they're college kids and they don't think about it. I feel like there needs to be a little more stressing of the importance of safety and these sort of steps with young people, because there seems to be, as all young people do, feel a little bit, unstoppable and, immune from anything. But until it happens, I don't know what it'll take for that. I don't know it ever will. I think there's a nice comfort in feeling you don't have to until it's too late. But that was a big point in this one. Let's talk about the motive here, and the void that still exists, at least as of now. We haven't, as of we're recording, the sentencing has not taken place, but when he did admit to the crimes, it was just a yes and a no type answer. What else do you think we're going to find out here? Do you think that we're going to learn more from Koberger about what his motivation was, and how he acted on it, why he acted on it? Or is this going to be something that he's going to go to his grave, or he's going to wait for his place and time to reveal?
I just, just personally, I don't believe the motive is this difficult. I think the motive is he's a sick individual who was the wallflower of life, that wanted to be this amazing, grandiose, loved, figured, and he absolutely dreamed about and fantasized about for years killing a woman who was asleep, who was beautiful, who meant his thought process, and attacking viciously and then sexually assaulting them. I think that's the motive. Mm-hmm. But your question, I think, is, are we going to hear it from Koberger's mouth?
Yeah.
And my point is, I don't trust anything he would ever say. Mm-hmm. I think he will definitely, if it is made available, he'll interview someday with probably multiple people. Hopefully someday he chooses the behavioral science unit of the FBI. They're called BAU now, analysis unit, because that's where the information is really important to put in their catalog of information, so that, purportedly you can identify when things like this might come. But Catherine Ramsland was his guidance counselor, taught him in four classes, and had a serial killer, I believe, right under her nose, and had no idea, as she well admits. Mm-hmm. I still think it's good to chronicle it and to understand these people. Mm-hmm. But I don't, I'm convinced that you can never see somebody and say, "Oh, there's one right there. He's going to do it," because I think there might be a lot of them out there, but they never act.
That's what I'm wondering about. We were talking earlier about the kind of the peeping Tom-ish type character early on, where he was looking in the window and such. there's probably a lot of that out there that we are never aware of, that do exist to this day, but they never go further. And that's the scary part of just being aware of your surroundings and what's out there. But how can you be aware when someone's, you know, out of reach and a bit out of sight, but they're still lurking? It's a scary thing to know that it might be out there and that in reality, the odds are fairly high that they are out there. When we're looking at Koberger's, you know, lack of admission of any sort of motive, but we're trying to understand where he was coming from, where his mind went so far off. Is that something that that really does serve a purpose to hear, if not just for the families to hear the twisted world of Brian Koberger, or is it just, as some would say, just the rantings of a madman? This made sense to me because that made sense to me, but in the real world, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
You know, I think in the right hands, meaning in the behavioral psychologist hands and in the hands of, you know, they like to call them profilers, mm-hmm. but people who actually spend their life's work, like a Dr. Gary Mercado, studying mass murderers, mm-hmm. I think this information is important to them so that they can get a true analysis of the psyche of people. You know, a lot of these people end up otherwise dying and never say a word. And I think this way you have an analysis in a totality from lots of different people who are cut from the same cloth that they can talk about because people are interested in it. Yeah. But I'm not sure, and not to be cynical, but I just don't know that other than it being sort of interesting, intriguing, however you want to call mm-hmm. it, trying to get into the mind of somebody like this, I don't think it has practical application for prevention,
yeah.
sadly.
Yeah. What happened inside that house on King Road isn't just a crime scene. It's a psychological battlefield. And what Jennifer helped us unpack today is exactly what the public's instinct to question the surviving roommate's actions were all about. The timing, their text, their silence, all of that. It misses the point entirely. Because this wasn't just fear. This was trauma in real time. Imagine waking up in a house that suddenly feels that wrong. You hear something. You see a masked figure. You don't understand what you're seeing, and then nothing. No screaming, no noise. Just the sudden sense that something isn't right in your body, your brain freezes, and you've never been in this life experience before because you're quite young still. That isn't cowardice, that's biology. The FBI understands this. That's why survivor interviews aren't interrogations, they're behavioral assessments. Investigators know that the timeline in a trauma victim's head is often fractured, that they'll remember smells before they remember sounds, that what they say in a text like, "I'm confused, RN," may be the clearest sign something inside them already knew the danger was there, even if they couldn't process it out loud. And then there's the aftermath, the weight of surviving when others didn't, the guilt, the scrutiny, the public spectacle. These roommates didn't ask to be in a murder mystery. They were college students who found themselves in the middle of something too horrifying to name. And now every action they took or didn't take is dissected on social media by people who've never stared down real terror. If you take nothing else from this episode, take this: silence after trauma doesn't mean nothing happened. It often means something unspeakable did. And as Jennifer laid out, law enforcement didn't see these survivors as unreliable. They saw them as essential, not for the courtroom, but for understanding the story that unfolded in that house before the sun came up. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage in this case or the many we cover for you right here. Next up, we're going to be getting close and closing out our series by stepping into the void, the unanswered questions, the missing motive, and whether Koberger will ever tell the story himself. Because even with the guilty plea, there's one thing that still haunts the case. Why? And that's where we're headed. So press subscribe so you don't miss any of that, whether it be on the podcast platforms, wherever you're listening, or on YouTube. Hit subscribe there. Check us out on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski to find us. And then hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case and the many that we cover for you right here. Even get in on commenting before anybody else if you want to become a premium subscriber on YouTube. Until next time. My name is Tony Brewski. We will talk again real soon.
The world of true crime never stops, and neither do we. Press subscribe now to get daily updates, in-depth analysis, and expert opinions from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.